Well, last week as we were going through chapter 5, I misspoke. I said we were going to finish chapter 5 today, which was last week, and everybody said, yeah, right. We'll be here till 2 o'clock. And we did not finish chapter 5, and that was not the intent. We start a new, sort of a new section today. Now, as we get into this, you'll see that it is directly related and built upon where we've already been with putting off the old and putting on the new. And in fact, with this issue of marriage, you know, there's nothing like marriage, the relationship of marriage, to humble you, to let you know how weak you are, to let you know how selfish you are, how self-focused you are. Somehow, God has used this. Not that there's a lot of reasons and purposes for marriage, but I really believe one of them is to conform us to the image of Christ. If you've been married for a while, there's probably been some low points in your marriage to where you just felt so weak that you couldn't go on, that you were worthless in a sense, that you couldn't do it. And there's something about it that opens your eyes to who you are and what God needs to do in you. Now, a lot of times that turns to what God needs to do in another person, but it works both ways. So I'm going to start you off here with a little analogy that is very limited in its scope. So you can't try to make it do too much. And I've used this before, so you can, if you've heard it before, Carlton, I know he's heard it, and Lori. So forgive me if you've heard it. When I was in high school, many years ago. In fact, this is recorded in an ancient document called the yearbook. We had this special event day called a field day. They used to have those. They still have those. And, you know, you go, you have races, and you have three-legged races and sack races. We had just kind of a fun day where the whole school comes out. Naturally, with all of the athletes and stuff out there, too, it can get fairly competitive. And not that I would participate in any of that. But this one particular race, I ran track, and this other guy that ran track, his name was Danny Tillman, otherwise known as the DT Express. And we decided we would team up on the three-legged race. So we had a few practice runs and that. And there were some other teams there that were certainly just as fast as us, maybe faster. And, you know, if you've ever done a three-legged race where it can be kind of a very non-coordinated thing, or every now and then you can get a couple steps right. Well, we lined up. It was a full 100-yard dash. And so all the folks lined up. And there were some other track guys, sprinters and stuff, that had entered this too. And so they had all these, you know, paired up with your legs tied together. And so Danny and I started off. And from the first step, it was like we were clicking. We were clicking. And, when you're tied to somebody like that, it's hard to run as hard as you can run. But I ran as hard as I could run, and he ran as hard as he can run, and we were like in sync. And it was just a silly field day, but it's funny, of all the athletic events that I've been involved in, that day stands out to me because it was synchronized, it just clicked. It just felt good. We ran step for step. We dusted off the whole field by 40 yards. We just both ran all out. It's just like one person. And there's something about that that clicked with me for marriage. For both men and women, if you don't want to be possessed by another person, if you want your independence, you want your individuality, you want your space, you want your own money, you want your own stuff, the marriage may not be what you thought. Now, I'm not saying it's not okay. We can have our own ministries. So, like I said, you can't take this analogy too far. And there wasn't much in the analogy about leadership and submission and all that. But there was something about the unity of that, about the not being your own person. If you're just going to be two individuals living together on any level, then you are completely misunderstanding marriage. If you don't want to belong to another person, then you are misunderstanding marriage. If you want your own money, you're misunderstanding marriage. You don't have the basic concepts down. Now, this reunion of man and woman, you know, it was literally, formerly, literally one flesh. You know, there was one man, and God took the woman out of the man, and now in this much more satisfying form, the two come back together to make one. And this is why, when a man loves his wife, he is loving his own flesh. Becoming one flesh, as Otland, I'll tell you some more about this book later possibly, but here's a quote about becoming one flesh. The profound fusion of two lives into one, shared life together by the mutual consent and covenant of marriage. It is the complete and permanent giving over of oneself into a new circle of shared existence with one's partner. And where we are headed today, this is really going to be an introduction to Ephesians 5, 21 through 33. Because where that passage is going to, you can open there, but where that's going to, you know, that foundational thing of love and respect. We've talked about it so many times before. How, you know, it doesn't tell the wife to love her husband. Certainly that is in there. She needs to. It tells the wife to respect her husband. In other words, if this thing's going to work, one of the man's basic needs is to be respected. And if this thing is going to work, one of the basic needs of a woman is to be loved. If she's not being loved, if she doesn't feel loved, then this running together thing is not going to work very well. And if the man does not feel respected, this running together thing is not going to work very well. But before we can even get to that great counsel of love and respect, we're going to go back today and do a little bit of things we've done before, but foundational things about marriage that we need to look at. In marriage, like our three-legged racers, we do have a primary goal, and we are to move together towards that goal. Now, that's going to require identifying the goal, and we'll try to do that before we get through this series. Now, the goal is not personal satisfaction. If that's the goal, then if your goal in marriage is personal satisfaction, then you're going to be stumbling all over yourselves, and you're not going to run in unity. There is a goal, and it's outside of the two of you. It's out there. And if you're running together with your eyes on that prize, then things will work in sync. And that's what old Danny Tillman and I did. We looked at the finish line. We weren't really looking at each other. We were looking at the finish line, and we were going for it with our whole heart. And the synchronism worked out in the process. Now, Adam and Eve had this perfect relationship. They were, the analogy of the triangle. When I think about Adam and Eve, my mind always goes to the triangle with God at the top and those two down here. Those two were not like straining and trying to draw together. Those two were going individually looking to God. As they did that, then their relationship becomes closer together. And that happens even today in our modern day age. The same thing. Not that we don't have to work on our relationship, certainly. If you've been in a marriage for any length of time, then you know it does require some work and some focus. But after this being together for a while, something begins to happen. And we start to take one another for granted. So we're going to try to get some principles down here that we'll take care of. So we're not going to go down a lot of bunny trails. I don't have a lot of really practical stuff for you today. We're going to look at some principles. But here is one thing, though. After a while, we begin to take one another for granted. You know how, when you were dating, that it was natural to focus on the other person's strengths. Do you remember that? You saw their strengths. You didn't focus on their weaknesses. Generally, if you were ever in a dating, courting relationship, and somebody was focusing on your weaknesses, you probably didn't marry that person. And rightfully so. Rightfully so. If it starts off like that, I don't know how much hope there is for it, because that's the way it tends to go. It tends to go towards you no longer see their strengths that once drew you. You begin to focus on their weaknesses. And most of us need to periodically, consciously, move back and remember what it means to exclusively love another person. There's a special, exclusive love between a husband and a wife that is only, your heart is only for that person. It's an exclusive relationship. And you pursue the affection of one person. Now, when you're married, you should not have to play this game of if that person is pursuing you, that or if they're not pursuing you, I need to step back. And you know the games that you play. That should not be a part of the marriage relationship. You pursue the affection of one person, and you have true, wholehearted value of them. So that's a part of this whole thing when we get to these principles we're going to talk about. I'm just putting this out so you can hang on to these and remember this should be the result of the things that we're talking about, the principles of God applied in marriage. This should be some of the things that you look for. And so there should be this pursuit of affection of one person towards another and valuing that person above all other people, yet pursuing God and His purposes first. That's the goal out there. And as we go through this, I think we'll discover God's design of marriage. Now, we talked about, if you remember back on Mother's Day and Father's Day, I knew we were going to come to this in Ephesians sooner or later. And so we had kind of an introduction to this on Mother's Day and Father's Day. And if this clicks with you somehow, you might want to go back and review that. It was God's design of women on Mother's Day and God's design of men on Father's Day, which just give you some of the masculine attributes that God put into men and the feminine attributes that God put into women. Different, but working together for the same purpose. So some of what we say today is going to be built on what we introduced back then. But so all this relational stuff that we're talking about, something happened to make this extremely difficult. This working together in unity, synchronized, moving towards a common goal that God has put out there. Not that we have come up with ourselves, but moving together towards a goal. Something happened to disrupt the relational aspect of that and the working together to move that. And you know what it is that happened, right? Sin. That happened and it messed up every relational aspect, not just in marriage, but in any relationship. But Adam and Eve, as soon as they sinned, what did they do? They covered up and they began blame shifting and they began playing all the relational emotional games that people play. And on top of that, there was the curse. The curse had a direct impact on their relationship, and we'll talk about that. And not only that, they now had a sin nature, a tendency to live for themselves rather than to put someone else's needs first. So things quickly got twisted, and relationships were a big part of what got twisted. So this marriage relationship that God designed, that God came up with, did not fundamentally change, though. It was designed back in the garden before the fall. So it did not fundamentally change, but it got twisted from sin. And so we want to come back to the original design. Now, one of the main problems that happened with the fall, now selfishness reigns. Selfishness reigns in almost every relationship. And so we want to be able to deal with that. So you see how this is built upon the put off and the put on. So we don't, right now, if we were just teaching this, I would feel the need to go back and teach all of that so that you would know how and be reviewed and remember what it means to put sin to death, to die to self, to put on Christ, because that's the only hope for a marriage relationship. If we're going to get back to the pre-fall design of man and the woman, then something has to happen in an individual. And you know what that is. It's salvation. A restoration of God's relationship to man. That's salvation. Restoring the relationship of God and man. You know, when that happens, you get a new nature. You get the ability to put on the new, put off the old. That doesn't mean it's going to happen automatically. So let me stop there just a minute. I'll try not to go down this bunny trail. I'm on a bunny trail, so I'm trying not to go too far down this trail. Salvation needs to have happened. You cannot expect the fruit of salvation from somebody that is not saved. Now, certainly there can be guidelines, there can be boundaries and all that stuff with those that are not believers. But for this pre-fall type of relationship we're talking about, it's only possible if you have a new nature. So a person has to be saved. Now, if I asked you today, are you saved? Most people would probably say yes. And then if I said, how do you know that you're saved? Then you might say, well, back in whenever, I went up front, I raised my hand in a service, I trusted Jesus as my personal Savior, I recognized that Jesus died on the cross for me, He was the substitution for me, I put my trust in Him, He died in my place, and He paid for my sins, filled me with the Holy Spirit, and I'm saved. I said, okay, well that's good, you just told me how to get saved. Now tell me how you know you're saved. That was my question. How do you know you're saved? That's how you get saved, that is true. It's by faith alone, in Christ alone. But how you know you're saved is if you abide in His Word. If there's been no change in your life, if people don't see a difference in you, if your husband and your wife don't see fruit in your life, oh, year after year, month after month, the decades go by, and there's no growth, you're still the same self-focused person that you ever were. Maybe you've matured a little bit, but there's been no real fruit. Real believers have real fruit in their life. They grow. They change. They mature. They become easier to live with, not more difficult to live with. So if you want to have a good marriage, you need to be saved. Not just had some experience of where you said you went down front, you raised your hand. Has there been a transformation in your life? Are you following Jesus? That's how you know you're saved. Once saved, always saved, all that. Yeah, I believe that. But how do I know I'm following Him today? That's how I know I'm saved. I abide in His Word. If you love me, you will obey me. If you want to have a good marriage, you need to be saved. That's a funny thing to preach to a bunch of Christians, isn't it? But it is the truth. It is the truth. So, that's the first step. So, there is hope. And a marriage being what God designed it to be. So wherever your marriage is, if you're struggling at the moment, it may be the best that's ever been right now. It still can improve. God has a design for it, and He has a plan for it. And part of the plan, if it's going to work, is putting the old man to death. Putting the deeds of the flesh to death. Putting sin to death. Putting, you know, all those sins we listed? Anger, lust, pornography, bitterness, all those things. See, Christians don't live like that. Christians have incidents, maybe, of sin. Yeah, they do. We do. We have incidents of sin. Christians do not live like that. That's not a pattern of living. So, if you have a pattern of anger, you need to go back and check, have I grown in this? What's going on with me in my relationship with the Lord? That's the thing that needs to be checked. Number one, before we go off in this direction of marriage, putting the deeds of sin to death, putting on Christ, the new life, and together being lights in a dark world. Now you can just multiply all the issues I talked about for the next generation. Because we have progressed in a self-obsessed culture over the past 20 years. Do you realize that? Our culture has become possessed, obsessed. There you go. I struggle with those words, you know. God has a sense of humor, doesn't He? Puts a guy that struggles with words and makes up words, He puts him up front to teach you. That's really funny. So, thanks, Lord, for the humility. So, we have, the last 20 years, our culture has progressed exponentially in being self-obsessed. So, your children, or maybe if you're a little younger than me, we all struggle with the same old nature. We struggle with the flesh. But it's become more and more prevalent in our culture. So, but of course, the problem has been there since the fall. Let's go to James 4, 1 through 3. Doesn't seem like we're really studying through Ephesians, does it? But we really are. James 4, 1 through 3. What causes fights and quarrels among you? Why would I pick this for a marriage talk? What causes fights and quarrels among you? Don't they come from our desires that battle within you? You want something, but don't get it. You kill and covet, but you cannot have what you want. You quarrel and fight. You do not have because you do not ask. When you ask, you do not receive because you ask with the wrong motives. You don't have the right goal in mind. That you may spend what you get on your pleasures. You would, and then it goes on. Well, let's go back up. There's another verse I want to read. James 3, 13 to 18. Who is wise and understanding among you? Let him show it by his good life, by deeds done in humility that comes from wisdom. But if you harbor bitter envy and selfish ambition in your hearts, do not boast about it or deny the truth. Such wisdom does not come down from heaven, but is earthly, unspiritual, of the devil. So think about the ugliness in relationships. Where does it come from? It comes from the flesh, your old nature. It comes from the devil. For where you have envy and selfish ambition, there you find disorder and every evil practice. But the wisdom that comes from heaven is first of all pure, then peace-loving, considerate, submissive, full of mercy, good fruit, impartial, and sincere. Peacemakers who sow in peace and raise a harvest of righteousness. That's a pretty good description of a godly marriage. That is. And this is where we've been in Ephesians over the past five messages. It's really, in a sense, training in how to have a good marriage. All that stuff, you could consider it. You could consider it that. The old nature, the flesh, the old man, even the curse itself fights against us. But there is a solution to it. And before we get into the nitty-gritty of how things are supposed to work, and this, back in Ephesians chapter 5, verse 21, it tells us, it gives us this picture of marriage. It tells us how it's supposed to work. Now, before we get into the nitty-gritty of that, we're going to go back to some foundational principles. And then after that, we'll get more to the how-to and get a clearer view of where you are headed in your marriage as described in this key passage. This Ephesians chapter 5, 21 to 33 is probably the key passage on marriage in the New Testament, possibly in the whole Bible. Genesis can give us some competition here, but it's built on the Genesis passage. And even Paul, in this passage, he refers back to the first three chapters, first two chapters of Genesis, when he's describing what marriage should be like, and also what family life should be like. So that's a key passage on marriage and family life. It's 5:21 through 6:4 in Ephesians. But we're going to go back to some foundational things before I start talking about love and respect. You need to understand God's design for marriage, or be reviewed about it a little bit more before we get into that. So let's take a quick look. We won't go into great detail here. We're going to take a quick look at what happened concerning the relationship of a husband and wife as a result of sin. So let's go back to Genesis chapter 3. You may not have noticed this, the direct with the curse is being started when God is sort of describing the curse and the result of sin. One of the things that he gets into right away is relational. The relationship between the husband and family issues that he gets into right away. So let's look at this 16 and 17. To the woman, he said, I will greatly increase your pains in childbearing, and with pain you will give birth to children. Now, he didn't take away from her the gift of bearing children. That was a gift to Eve, that she would bear children. But he brought pain with it. That was a part of the curse, horrible pain that comes with it, and reminding us, her particularly, of the curse. The next thing he gets into, your desire will be for your husband, and he will rule over you. Now, this has been somewhat of a misunderstood verse, and this is not the description of, it's a twist. It's not the description of the God-ordained marriage. You see, some people will look at that and think that. It's not a description of what marriage is supposed to be like. It's how the curse affected marriage. This word desire, in fact, well, this word desire here is used, I could only find it three times in the Bible, in the Hebrew portion of the Bible, in the Old Testament. So, in two of those times, it's used in a negative sense. One time it is used in somewhat of a positive sense in the Song of Solomon, but both times it's used here in Genesis, it's used in a negative sense. And so I researched that word a little bit, and it does mean desire. It means a stretching out and a reaching towards, but it comes from a root word meaning to run after or run over. To run over. Now, does that make a little more, starting to make a little more sense now? Sorry. We all have our little things coming to us here. I'll get to the men in a minute. So, the husband's, the wife's desire will be, and I think this plays out here, her desire will be to overrun her husband, to reverse the roles at some level, to not be what she feels like is controlled. And the husband's desire will be to rule over his wife. Rule is not a good word here. Rule is more like dominate. To dominate or to simply, selfishly use. So you see, this is a twist on the original plan of the relationship. There's another place where this word desire, just to show this to you, is used, if you look at it, trust me, I'm no Hebrew scholar here, but if you look at it in the Hebrew text, it has the same rhythm, the same structure, the sentences look almost exactly the same as 4:7, where it uses the word desire. If you look there at 4:7, it says, if you do what is right, will not you be accepted? If you do not do what is right, sin is crouching at your door. It desires to have you, but you must master it. It's the very same Hebrew word, only used three times in the Bible. Now, the wrong... because Eve usurped Adam's headship in the temptation. Do you see that? She didn't inquire of her husband. Satan tempted... part of her temptation was to usurp the headship of Adam. Because he was tempting her to make her own decision, to be her own person, to rule, to make her own choices apart from Adam. And because she usurped his headship, God, in a sense, you know how God, this is a pattern of how God does things. He hands her over to the misery of competition with her rightful head. That is a miserable thing. The competition between a husband and a wife for headship in the family. That is a miserable thing. It causes misery in both parties. The outcome of this looks different in different cultures. Just because you see some Muslim culture and you see the women are all submissive and they're not saying anything wrong, well, they better not say anything wrong. It doesn't mean that their attitude is the right kind of submission. That they're being dominated. Where it says, husbands, rule over your wives. They're being dominated and mistreated. Now, in a different culture like ours, where masculinity is looked down upon in so many ways when it comes to true biblical masculinity, it is leadership, headship. It's looked down upon because we're supposed to all be the same and act the same and look the same and be everything's cool, everything's okay, we're all just alike. Then, in our culture, you will find a different type of rule. It'll be just a man just looking out for himself and not looking after his family. An indifferent self-focus is how it's going to look in our culture. But they're both are the same. You see the same basic problem. It's a far cry from the humble male leadership and female help, godly submission and Christ-like love that we find described in Genesis chapters 1 and 2 and in Ephesians chapter 5. It's a far cry from that. The specific curse on Adam, if you keep reading there, has to do both with his eating of the fruit and his handing over of leadership. And God speaks directly to him about this. He handed over his headship without even a teaching moment without any real resistance, he just handed over his headship. But even in this, their relationship shows hope. If you look back, if you're in Genesis, if you look back, where Adam's response was in turning to Eve after the curse, and in hope, he calls her the mother of all living. And in a sense, he's saying to God, I believe you, God, and I will honor you, Eve. And it gives us a glimpse of hope for the marriage relationship. So, I know I'm all over the place there, but hopefully we're getting some foundational issues here. So let's look quickly at the male-female equality and male headship that God designed in the marriage. You see, God wanted Adam to see clearly that none of these wonderful creatures that God had made were image bearers. They did not bear the image of God. All these wonderful, just exotic, beautiful creatures that God had made. And he parades them all before Adam. And Adam gets to name them all. And something's missing. And God wants Adam to see in this, none of those, as close as they could be to him, none of them were image bearers, so none of them could be a true co-laborer, a partner in the mission and the purpose that God had given him. And I believe God wanted Adam to see this clearly, that none of them bore the image of God, none of them were his equal. Now comes one that's going to be his equal. And that's where he says, God created man in his own image, in the image of God he created them, male and female, and then Adam responds with, this is bone of my bone, flesh of my flesh. She should be called woman, for she was taken out of man. Adam sees clearly, this one is in the image of God. This one is my equal. This is my equal, my spiritual equal, because she is equal in the image of God, and I am equally in the image of God. But it also says, because she's in the image of God, because she was his equal, then she is a suitable helper for him. She is to help him accomplish the purposes that he, God, had given to Adam. It could only be done by an equal, a co-laborer, a suitable helper. So even in the perfectness of the garden, something was missing. And so God gave him this missing ingredient, and of course, he is overwhelmed. He's overwhelmed at this beautiful creature that is equal to him, also in the image of God. But if you miss this foundational concept, there's a foundational concept that we miss even in Bible teaching churches. We talk about wives submit to your husbands and husbands. We talk about that a lot. But we don't really talk about this because we think it sounds demeaning. Hogwash. It is not demeaning. It's ordained by God. How could it be demeaning? A woman in the image of God. And she is to be his suitable helper. Only if she's in the image of God could she be his suitable helper. Helper and headship. The two H's. You can remember that. That is foundational to understanding the marriage relationship. You will not get the love and respect of Ephesians unless you understand this foundational aspect. You can try to apply it in little bits and pieces, but if you don't get the principle down, and if you don't have the headship running after the right things with his whole heart after the mission of God and a suitable helper by his side in sync, then we will not have the marriages that God intended us to have. The man was not created to help the woman. He never helps me. The man was not created to help the woman. The woman, the reverse is true. The woman was created to help the man. Now, we're not talking about dishes and housework. Guys, we ought to help. We ought to help. Every chance we get, we ought to help. Sorry. I knew I was setting you up there, wasn't I? But there's a baseline principle. I said that, though, on purpose to let it sink in for a minute. Because there's wrong thinking. I think women think about this different. Even good solid Christian women, they think about this, and the whole thing about their whole life is that he's not helping me in my life. That's not the right principle. The man should be thinking in this whole principle of life, but you see, he's not just worried about his family. He is worried about his family. He's got the bigger picture. He has the purposes of God on his mind. He's pursuing with his whole heart, and he's saying, come on, woman, help me with this. You are my suitable helper. You're the only one that can help me in a co-laboring, running in sync. You're the only one that God has given me. I have no other. You must help me. That's different than the woman looking at her enclosed life and saying, you don't help me with the kids. You don't help me with the house. You don't help me with... Well, yeah, help with those things. Please do. But let's think about that way of thinking. Where is the whole thing going? There needs to be a thinking transition. But you see what it does, what it throws into the man's side of the court, don't you? You see what it throws on his side of the court. We'll get to that. So you'll never have true love and respect. Men are built like that, right? We need respect. You women like to make fun of that, and you don't really understand it. But we need that. That's a part of our makeup. We need to be treated and spoken to with respect. We appreciate that. R-E-S-P-E-C-T. Written by a man, sung by a woman, written by a man. Women want to be loved. They need to be loved. Men kind of make fun of different aspects of that sometimes. But women need to be loved. They need to feel their love. But you see, we like to focus on that because that's like practical, this real life. We can touch it. We can feel it. We can get hold of it. But that is meaningless unless we have this whole big concept of headship and helper. Unless we really have that down and the purposes of God at the center of our lives. The man is to love his wife by accepting the primary responsibility for making their partnership, their marriage, their family, a place for displaying the glory of God and the cause and the purpose of Christ in the world. And the woman is to support him with her whole heart in that undertaking. His suitable helper. Now, I'll tell you something. In real life living, this is rare. Even in Bible teaching churches, this is a rarity. This is my goal. To see every family living like that. That is my goal. So what we have from the very beginning then, just as review. We have female equality. The man and the woman are equal in that they bear God's image equally. Also from the beginning, before the fall, before sin ever entered the world, we have male headship. In the partnership of, I'm reading this because it's a quote here, in the partnership of two spiritually equal human beings, man and woman, the man bears the primary responsibility to lead the partnership in a God-glorifying direction. And that is the foundation that the marriage relationship is built upon. So God designed us male and female in a specific way. Even though it's marred by sin and rebellion, He still has His design. It's affected by the curse. If we follow our natural tendency, we will not get it right. You should know this by now. If we follow our natural tendency in this relationship thing, we will not get it right. That is a good reason to study these things that we're studying. Because we get God's perspective. God designed it. We remind ourselves this is how He designed it. We fall in line with His design and we get good results. We eat from the right tree, you get the right fruit. We follow His design. We get good results. So that's why we study this. Remind ourselves how it works. The designer says it works best like this. Then we should go with this. That's what the designer says. Now that, of course, takes knowledge, but it also takes personal, full submission to Christ, dying to sin, putting on Christ. We must be able to put on the new man, so we must be saved if we're going to do this. That's why I talk about salvation when I talk about the marriage relationship. We must be able to put on the new man. Now, again, a key that many reject is that idea of the helper. So I want us to get an understanding here. The woman helping the man as he leads in a God-glorifying direction. Now, as I said before, we have needs. You know, men have their needs and women have their needs. And we need to try to understand those things and we need to try to meet those things. Because that makes the whole thing smoother. And it makes us be able to do things in sync. And in this next section of Ephesians that we're getting into, we'll get some specifics on how to do some of those things. How to do our part in this God-designed partnership. And the model we will get for headship, we're going to look at a model for headship. And right there in Ephesians, the model for headship we get is Jesus Himself, who is the opposite of male domination that we see in Genesis 3:16. Or selfish isolation, or whatever it is. However men like to respond, it's the same thing. Which we could describe as assertion, male rule in the wrong way is assertion of man's will over the woman's will, clueless to her spiritual equality and value. That's what the direction, the natural tendency for a man to go. So we have here a problem of role reversal. You realize that if the importance of this hasn't struck you yet, think about it like this. The first sin, the fall, could be said to have taken place because of role reversal. If you really look at the nuts and bolts of it. Adam wasn't doing his job. Eve wasn't submitting to him. He wasn't taking the headship. She was being independent. She knew a better way to do it. And she was going to do it. Somebody promised he was going to do it. And Adam didn't have the courage to step up. Adam was following instead of leading. Eve was usurping. But notice what God said. What's the first thing that God said after he came looking? What did God say? Eve, where are you? No. Adam, where are you? You didn't do your job, Adam. Oh, there's conflict in your house. The children are not misbehaving. The household isn't going the way it ought to go. Husband, where are you? Where are you? He didn't ask the wife. Yeah, but I was off at work and she was there and didn't know how to handle the kids. Husband, where are you? Sure, you got to be at work. But you still offer kind, gentle, compassionate leadership, engaged in what is going on. And you have your home passionately headed in God's direction for the purposes of Christ. Husband, where are you? Adam, where are you? That's the first thing that God came looking for. He came looking for the man. He was the head of the relationship. Doesn't that make sense? That's what he would do. But notice who spoke to Eve. Satan. He went to Eve. He came to Eve. You decide, Eve. You lead the way, Eve. He's not paying attention. You get what you want. You get what you want, Eve. Satan spoke to Eve. He was getting her to usurp the authority of the man. Just like Satan himself usurped God's authority, decided for himself what was best and the right way. He attacked Adam's headship. So, when we get to 5:19 and 20, back to Ephesians. Through with Genesis for the moment. This section opens up with verse... Remember we talked about verse 21, which is a transitional verse that applies to the verses that we were just talking about, but it also applies to the verses that are to come next. And he's talking about this, so it applies to the marriage relationship. It says, submit to one another out of reverence for Christ. He's saying this is the same thing to the church as he would say to a marriage. That there is a voluntary yielding to others in love. It's the same thing as talked about in Philippians chapter 2. In humility, consider others better than yourself. So, there's not this sort of, people like to give this kind of picture of the Bible or Christians teach that this husband ruling over with this authoritative thing over his home. But it's not. It's in humility, considering others better than yourself. in service, leading, following the example of Christ. And that's the way he opens up this section. Submit to one another out of reverence for Christ. Then he goes on to describe what marriage is to portray. He talks about the roles in marriage. And we're not going to get into all this now. But I wanted to build this foundation of this ties back to headship. It does. It ties back to the helper and headship, the original plan for marriage. And that's what this wives submit to your husbands as to the Lord, and the husband is to love his wife. So let's read verse 33. We'll close with that. And then he's going to give this beautiful description of what the marriage is supposed to portray. He wraps it up with verse 33, the most powerful bit of counsel set within the grand picture of marriage. This is some practical, feet on the ground counsel to you if you are married, because this is how you are to treat your partner. Verse 33. However, each one of you also must love his wife as he loves himself. The wife must respect her husband.